I'm a teacher at a fine arts high school, and students and faculty are all engaged in some kind of artistic expression, including visual art, crafting art, dance, theater, creative writing, vocal music, and instrumental music. And each of the teachers generally has some expertise in one of the arts, except for me. Of course, I'm a core teacher. I teach social studies, strictly academic subjects, so I'm not particularly gifted in the arts unless you call rhyming some poetry an art form. And one of our faculty members is a top violin player for the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas. This orchestra is also known as SONA, and its performance hall is the Walton Arts Center in downtown Fayetteville, Arkansas. From time to time, I hear this faculty member playing violin in school in her room. She's practicing for some upcoming event. Playing a musical instrument for a top-notch organization requires quality and consistency, and that requires daily discipline. When a violin player or other musicians are seated in an orchestra, the position that they are seated in is referred to as a chair. The top violinist seated in the first chair and is referred to as first chair. All other violinists are considered second chair. And it's safe to say the second chair violinists aspire to become first chair violinists themselves someday. So if you've been to an orchestra performance, you'll have watched and heard the performers tuning up their stringed instruments. And generally it sounds awful, just a cacophony while each of the performers does a last-minute tuning of their violin. I'm not a stringed instrument player, and I'm not particularly gifted with music, so I always wonder why they just couldn't hurry up with that process, just get it over with, the tuning, and just start playing. They act so fussy, and it seems like such a fruitless waste of time. Just be happy and play your instrument already, I thought. And, of course, then there's this expression that I thought of, well, what does fiddle around mean? Well, people that fiddle around. So I went to the Cambridge Dictionary, and it says to spend time doing small things that are not important or necessary. For example, I was just fiddling around in the kitchen, not really accomplishing anything. Another meaning is to take part in an activity that doesn't achieve anything, or particularly if it annoys someone. So fiddling around is part of the English language. One of my grandfathers would visit the farm while I was growing up, and he would fiddle around with the engines. He was trying to get the tractor to maybe run a little better, or he would fiddle around with a piece of equipment to see how it worked. I remember he was fiddling around with a hammer mill one time, and it was run with a belt, a long belt from a tractor and a pulley over to the hammer mill. And it was winter time, and he was one of those curiosity seekers, wanted to see how everything worked. He got a little bit too close to the belt and the hammer mill and caught his sleeve in the belt by the pulley. Fortunately, although it was winter, he had his coat unbuttoned. Had his coat been buttoned, it would have been a tragic story I'm telling you today. But as it were, his coat was unbuttoned, the sleeve caught, he twisted, and the belt and the pulley ripped his coat right off of him as he turned. He was fiddling around, just trying to see how things work. The fiddling, in the musical sense, could refer to any stringed instrument. Therefore, a violin would be a fiddle, but not all fiddles are violins. You could have all kinds of different kinds of stringed instruments when you say they're fiddling around. And then there's an expression that gives rise to another question. What does it mean to play second fiddle? Well, in the English language, if you take a look at onestopenglish.com, they give rise to this meaning expression of playing second fiddle. And they say the expression to play second fiddle can be used in a wide variety of contexts and means to be less important or powerful than someone else. Unsurprisingly, the expression is generally held to have its origins in the world of music. In early orchestras, the most prominent and highly profile member of the orchestra was the musician who played the lead or first violin. Naturally, there would also be other violinists in the string section of the orchestra, but those would not be as important or honored as the lead violinist. The other violinists became known as second fiddles, and the expression has now become firmly entrenched in the English language. Well, the title of today's message is Playing Second Fiddle. We have a number of biblical examples as to how some people handled not being in first place, not being necessarily in the spotlight. We're going to take a look today how some people handled playing second fiddle, how they handled being in second place, and then what lesson can we derive from that. The first example I want to call your attention to is the example of Aaron. Now, Aaron was a brother of Moses, so in order to understand the story of Aaron, we must first, of course, briefly cover the story of Moses, and we turn to Exodus 2 for that in verse 1. In Exodus 2, verse 1, we begin with this story of Moses. A man of the house of Levi took a wife of the daughter of a Levi, meaning of the same tribe. And she conceived and bore a son, and when the son saw that when she was a beautiful child, she hid him for 3 months. Well, this is the time when Pharaoh was wanting the Israelite babies or the Hebrew babies to be killed because they were simply reproducing faster than what the Egyptians were. And so they wanted the midwives to kill the babies. So the mother birthed him in secret and hid him for 3 months. How hard is it to hide a baby? I would say pretty hard. I've had babies. They make noise. They get wet. They get dirty. And their method of communication is not by blinking or winking the eye. It's not by beckoning with a finger. They cry. And if you don't, they're going to get a rash and they're going to cry even more. So she hid him for 3 months. Now, at 3 months of age, what happens? The babies start to learn what to roll over, things like that. They're starting to become a little bit more active. When she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes or a basket, daubed it with pitch or asphalt, and put the child in it and laid it on the reeds by the river bank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. So he had an older sister. So somebody was watching over, don't know exactly how much older, but several years older, old enough to pay attention to this basket. The mother couldn't. She had another child that she had to take care of. In fact, a three-year-old, as we'll come to see later. And we all know that three-year-olds can be very, very active, as can two-year-olds. Had a three-year-old granddaughter that this last week crashed off of a chair, landed on her nose on the floor on the metal bar of a swing that baby brother was in, and her nose took the blunt, bro, and yesterday morning she had surgery. After several days, poor little three-year-old, all bruised up, feeling poorly, and I don't know exactly what they did, but she's got the big old bandage on her nose trying to comfort her mommy from crying so much. But three-year-olds can be very busy, so I imagine that Moses' mother was very busy with her three-year-old little boy. And so let's jump then from in this story, as in Exodus 3, we're going to now go back to a time when Moses was called for a special mission in Exodus 3, starting in verse 10. And God spells out what Moses' job is to do, is to lead the children of Israel, get them out from Pharaoh. And what does Moses say in verse 10? Well, first the instructions are in verse 10. Come now, therefore, in Exodus 3:10, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Verse 11, but Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He hadn't lived with Israelites since he was 3 months old, since he was adopted out, taken to Pharaoh's court, raised as an Egyptian in the Egyptian court. So he's saying, wait a minute here. Why me? We ever think that sometimes ourselves? Why was I called to do a particular job? And Moses was really puzzled by all this. God goes through and chapter 3 and into chapter 4 and explains what he wants done. And then we get to Exodus 4 and verse 10. And Moses now is continuing with his pleading that this not fall upon him. And he's giving his reasons why. In Exodus 4:10, and Moses said to the Lord, O Lord, I'm not eloquent, neither before nor since. You've spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Verse 11, so the Lord said to him, who's made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say. Moses was unconvinced. Verse 13, but he said, oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. Isn't there someone else that can do this? Someone who can speak clearly and communicate what you want. Verse 14, so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. And look, he is also coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, you will be glad. He will be glad in his heart. Now you shall speak to him and put words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do. Verse 16, so he shall be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God. Whoa, here's his older brother, and Moses is now going to have great authority over his older brother. And you shall take this rod in your hand, which you shall do signs. So God is having none of this business of being talked out, of having Moses. Moses was picked for a particular reason. And to make it really awkward, he picked his older brother to be, who is, by admission here, by the record, can speak well, to do this. Immediately I thought, well, I've got an older, smarter, better-looking brother who can speak well, you know, and yet I'm called dear. So I understand that a bit. Now let's go to Exodus 4, down to verse 27. And here's the instructions that the Lord said to Aaron. Go to the wilderness, meet Moses. So he went and met him on the mountain of God and kissed him, which was a greeting at the time. Verse 28, so Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord, who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel, and Aaron spoke all of the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. So the Lord had spoke to Moses, Moses spoke to Aaron. Now we have this ability to translate to everyone. And then he, meaning Moses, did signs in the sight of the people. He had God had given Moses a rod that he was to conduct miracles and signs with. Verse 31, so the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord visited the children of Israel and he had looked on their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. Saying, you know, maybe there is a possibility here. Maybe there's a chance that we can be salvaged. In Exodus 7, let's go to verse 1 in Exodus 7 as we follow this story, as we're building to understand what the function of Aaron was. In Exodus 7, verse 1, so the Lord said to Moses, see, I've made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. So they were a pair. One was bringing the authority of God, and the other one was the spokesman at this time. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell the Pharaoh and send the children of Israel out of the land. Verse 6, and Moses and Aaron did so just as the Lord commanded them, and they did. And Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. Now we have the age gap, 3 years. Age gap here. Now we know there's three children because in 1 Chronicles 6:3, it very specifically says, the children of Amram were Aaron, Moses, and Miriam. And it goes on to give the sons of Aaron as well. So we know there are three children in the family, the older sister, and then two boys. And if we take a look as we follow the story of Aaron in Exodus 16 and verse 2, then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Now here they're saying, what did you do? Bring us out here to die? And who are they blaming? Are they blaming Moses? Well, Aaron was the one that was talking. So they're complaining against Moses and Aaron. Aaron was just the spokesman. He was doing what he was told, and yet he was getting hooked with the blame with all of the people as well. So when you're in the presence of a supervisor, you're going to take the hit if you're also the spokesman for that supervisor. And I'm sure that had to be problematic for Aaron because he was, after all, playing second fiddle. He was the number two man here. Let's take a look in Exodus 17 as we go through this. And here we have the Amalekites are fighting, came to fight Israel, and Israel was defending themselves. And so we start in verse 8, Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim, and Moses said to Joshua, choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy. So they took a stone and put under him. And he sat on it, so he had a place to sit. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side, one on the other, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. So here you have Moses, the leader, but his hands are being held up with the rod of God. In other words, prevailing to for the children of Israel to prevail. But who was there holding up the hands? And one of those was Aaron on one side. It was his job then to be a supporter, to hold up the hands of the one who was the leader. Well, then we read, if we go to Exodus 32, what happens with Aaron doesn't have Moses around. And this is a circumstance when Aaron is left up to his own devices in Exodus 32, starting in verse 1. Now, Moses at this point was up on the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments. And verse 1, now when the, and of course he's gone for 40 days. And this is a long time after a while, you know. They don't have clocks and calendars like we do, but they can count the number of times the sun rises. And 40 days, you know, is a long time. And the people said, so it was after a while. We don't know how many days, but it wasn't very long. And they said, when the people saw Moses delayed from coming to the mountain, people gathered together Aaron and said to him, come, let us make gods that shall go before us. And as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. He's not here. He's gone. Anything can happen in the wilderness. There are wild beasts out there. There are lions and other creatures. He was an old man. Who knows what could have happened? So what is Aaron's big decision in verse 2? So Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. How conveniently they replaced God with a golden calf, a statue. So here's Aaron. He doesn't have the presence of Moses to keep him on the straight track. And they look to him as being the leader. After all, he was the guy that was always saying something. And so what did he do? He acquiesced. He said, well, okay, well, we'll have to do something here. And what was their background? They saw all the gods of Egypt, all the various animals. So we see the strength of character here when no one was looking. In other words, when the supervisor wasn't looking. We continue on in Exodus 32 and verse 21. Moses comes back down. And Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you've brought such a great sin upon them? Now, to his credit, and Aaron doesn't quite get it all together here, but he's on the way to turning around, and he said, don't let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know these people, they're set to do evil. For they said to me, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. And I said to them, well, who has ever had gold? Let him bring it. And they gave it to me. I cast it in the fire, and then this calf came out. Wow. How many of you have done that? Thrown stuff into the fire, and somehow this idol came out. Not too likely. So Aaron he's trying to take the blame off of himself there, although he was the chief decision maker at the time. Could have said yes, could have said no. He chose to say yes. Verse 25, when Moses saw the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies. What kind of an example was that? Aaron was left to be their leader while Moses was on the mountain, and in front of their enemies they were creating a golden calf. Verse 35, so the Lord plagued the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron made. Basically, God allowed plagues to come over them. They removed his protection there. So Aaron was a disappointment in this case when he didn't have supervision. And then we go to Numbers 12. We read about another circumstance. Because Moses is making these decisions and you don't have, you don't have his brother and sister always agreeing with all of Moses' decisions. His older sister and his older brother, and there's the little brother. I don't know how many of you have little brothers. I have a little brother. And I have friends of mine have kids who have a youngest brother in the family. In fact, a friend of mine, his youngest son, his name starts with the letter R. And their kids played with my kids, and my oldest girl couldn't ever remember his name. But the youngest brother liked to crow a lot. He liked to, you know, liked to talk. And so there it was, my daughter, who was 3 or 4 years old, called him Rooster. And I thought, how fitting, he was always crowing like a little rooster. And how many cases do we have here where the older brother and older sister were looking upon the little one? You know, the one that was raised in a foreign country, as it were, raised in Egypt. Not really one of us. We just got stuck with him coming along. And so in Numbers 12, we hear this dissension about Aaron and Miriam against Moses. In verse 1, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman, and they said, "Is the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" He's gone some of the time. I mean, we're left here. We've got to do, actually, we're doing the heavy lifting here. We're doing the hard work. People have to look to us for the to serve them as their leader. And who does he think he is? After all, he's not following our customs and manners. And so then what we read in at the end of verse 2, "And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all the men who were on the face of the earth. And the Lord heard it and said, why were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?' When the cloud departed from the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Aaron turned to Miriam, and there she was, a leper. So Aaron said to Moses, 'Oh, my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly, in which we have sinned.'" Aaron recognized this. It was foolishness. Now, Aaron was stricken from time to time with making bad decisions, but you'll notice that he turned around. Aaron recognized that when he was given a harsh example, that this was a big mistake. In Numbers 20, we read another example of what Aaron did, starting in, and this was a time when the children of Israel were thirsting for water. And they were thirsting, and all of their livestock were thirsting. And they were in great trouble. You can't live very long without water. You know, there's, what do you do without water? I think after 3 days, you're pretty well going to melt away. You can make it for a long time without food, but not a long time without water. Makes me think of the story of the evil King John in England in the early 1200s AD, where his opponents, he would lock them in the Tower of London and they would thirst them to death. It would only take a few days. The tongue gets very dry and wooden and turns black. It's a very painful death. So the people here are very thirsty, and we can understand that. If you're thirsty, you're thirsty. And what did Aaron and Moses do? And of course, it's in an earlier passage. Well, let's read here in verse 10. "And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and he said to them, 'Hear now, you rebels.'" Moses and Aaron were together. Aaron is now the spokesman. "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" Notice the terminology. Aaron said, "Must we do this?" Not, "Let's look to God to relieve this situation." We, meaning I and Moses here, are going to do this. Verse 12, "Then God spoke to Moses and Aaron, 'Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them.'" They took the prerogatives of God, and they took it upon themselves. So we have this example of Aaron. He was the second fiddle to his older sister Miriam. He was a second fiddle to his younger brother Moses. And Aaron generally did well when he was a spokesman for Moses, but Aaron was weak when Moses was not present. And yet there's the occasion that cost him the entry into the promised land when he didn't follow God, but followed the error of Moses in saying, we provided water from the rock. And yet Aaron was still honored as the Levitical line of the priesthood flowed through him and the tribes and the tribe of Levi. We read that in Numbers 3, verses 8 and 10. I'm not turning there. So what's the lesson we can learn from Aaron is, how strong and faithful are we when we're left to make a decision in the absence of someone who's over us? How strong and faithful are we when we're left to make a decision in the absence of someone who is over us? We have another example of somebody who played number two, who played second fiddle, who was the runner-up, second place, as it were. We read the first mention of this person is in Exodus 17, verse 9. Example number two is about Joshua. And Moses said to Joshua, Exodus 17, 9, choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Now, we referred to that instance earlier. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. Verse 10, what did Joshua do? Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek, and Moses and Aaron Hur went to the top of the hill. Joshua obeyed at the potential cost of his life to go out, round up, and organize an army of people who were not used to being an army, having fled Egypt, and now having to battle this enemy group of Amalek. And Joshua, there's no record of him doing the opposite and saying, wait a minute, we don't have any armaments, we don't have any training, we don't. It doesn't tell us that. It just says Joshua did as Moses said to him. Now, in Exodus 24, verse 13, we hear a reference to what Moses referred to as Joshua. And Moses arose with his assistant, Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. So Joshua is being called an assistant. So Moses can't do it alone. Remember, his father-in-law Jethro says, you need to provide an organization for the children of Israel, lest you be wearied. So Moses has an assistant, a much younger man named Joshua, and he's going up to get the Ten Commandments, and he goes, and of course, Moses is the only one that can go all the way up, but you have Joshua coming halfway up the mountain and went with him on that trip. Then Joshua was also one of those that Moses called in Numbers 13 and verse 16, about one of those who were going to spy out the land to be that was the promised land. And Moses, in Numbers 13, 16, Moses called Joshua the son of Nun, was selected as being one of those. He wanted to pick people that he thought he could trust. And in Numbers 14, verse 6, but Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who spied out the land, tore their clothes. They were the ones that came back. They gave a good report, and the other spies did not give a good report. And so there were two that gave a good report. So I'm sure that endeared Moses to those that were giving a good report there. We read on in Numbers 14:30 that except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun, you shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. So only two of all of those people that came out of Egypt and their families, meaning that were over 60 years old, would enter the promised land. So now we go at the end of the book of Numbers, Numbers 27. We go to the verse 15, and this is where Moses is nearing his death. And Moses is now asking God for a new leader for Israel. And I find it interesting how he mentions it. Then Moses spoke in Numbers 27, 15. And Moses spoke to the Lord saying, let the Lord God of the spirits of all flesh set a man over the congregation, who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. So Moses is recognizing his time is limited. He knows he's not going to be able to cross the Jordan into the promised land. And he's praying and he's saying, we need a leader for these people. And verse 18, and the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, son of Nun, with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand upon him. Set him before Eleazar the priest, that's the son of Aaron, and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children may be obedient. And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. And his word shall go out, and his word they shall come in, and he and all the children of Israel with him, and all the congregation. Verse 22, Moses did all as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest, before the congregation, and laid his hands on him and inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. So there was this this ordination, as it were, that we have a new leader as we are passing from the leadership of Moses to that of Joshua. What do we learn from this example, number two, about Joshua? Joshua followed the instructions of Moses, as Moses listened to God, even in the face of death, as they fought the Amalekites. Joshua gave a good report when others were afraid of the promised land, were afraid what was in it. They were afraid to seize the promises of God. Joshua saw the opportunities, not the obstacles. Joshua followed God's instructions to take the promised land. We just read Joshua 1 and verses, the first 8 or 10 verses. We see what the promises that God gave to Joshua. And then, once in promised land, that Joshua established order, dividing the land among the tribes, providing some orderliness to it. So what example? We have this example of Joshua. He was number two for a long time, and he had to learn at the side and at the feet of another leader. The lesson we must ask ourselves here for this example too is, do we keep the instructions of God foremost in our mind when we follow the instructions of a human leader? Joshua could have followed others, the other spies in the land. He didn't want, be like the rest of the crowd, but he followed the instructions of God and the instructions of Moses when he was to give an accurate report of the land. Example number three is David. And we know the story that about Samuel anointing Saul to be the first king over Israel. And Saul disgraced himself. We won't go through that scenario. And so God told Samuel, we need to have, I need you to anoint a future king to prepare him. In 1 Samuel 16, but the Lord said to Samuel, this is when he's visiting the sons of Jesse, do not look on his appearance or at his physical stature, because I refused him. We're talking about Eliab, the oldest son of Jesse, in 1 Samuel 16:7. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Verse 8, so Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass and so forth. And it goes through all of the sons, and it was told Samuel, neither is the Lord chosen this one. Nope, not this one. You go down the line, all these fine, upstanding young men. And finally, Samuel says to Jesse in verse 10, the Lord hasn't chosen these. Are these all the young men there are? And what does Jesse say? There remains yet the youngest. And there he is keeping the sheep. In other words, he's out doing what he's supposed to be doing right now, because he couldn't possibly be the one that could be a future king. Samuel says to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes here. Ever thought about being a barber? They stand on their feet all day. I think about those people. Commonly is what they get varicose veins. They're always standing in one place. And that's got to be, and then they put their arms up in the air. Okay. Try to do that for just 5 minutes. Stand in one place, put your arms in the air. Well, if you're going to tell somebody I'm going to stand in one place all day, you're going to be shifting your weight from one side to the other. Not going to sit down. In other words, make haste. Let's do this right away. Let's get this done. And what did Jesse do? He sent and brought him in. And in verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. The Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel arose and then went on. So this was an odd circumstance. David, again, was the youngest in the family, the youngest. So he was playing second fiddle to everybody. to all the older siblings, because he was, even his father didn't consider him that he would be material that he should bring before Samuel the prophet. And then, of course, we know the story of the slaying of Goliath, and David then eventually becomes a soldier under King Saul. And in 1 Samuel 18 and verse 5, it's an interesting verse. And so 1 Samuel 18:5, when Saul asked him to be a soldier and go out and fight, so David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. That's an interesting phrase. He went out wherever the king said go, he would go there to fight on behalf of King Saul and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. I have a son-in-law from England. And years ago, daughter and son-in-law were living in the outskirts of London. He was working for a big company, American company, and its distribution place in England. He's a product design engineer. And the administrative decision was, in America, we are going to close our European office, and we'll administer, because of the modern electronics, we'll administer everything from Chicago. We no longer feel as though we need to have an office to cover Europe, so we can close the office in England. We'll just bring the manager over from the English, from the European office, from England, we'll bring him over to Chicago. And what did the manager say? He said, I'm not coming unless you bring Sam along. Well, who's Sam? Well, that was my son-in-law, who is a product design engineer. And what did Sam do? He always gave credit to the boss for every accomplishment, propped him up, as it were, rhetorically held up his arms, made the boss look good. So when it came time to close the office and move the boss to America, the boss says, I'm not coming without Sam. Sam did what David did. He went wherever the boss sent him, and he behaved wisely. He gave credit to wherever he could. And then the company sent him to America, paid the closing costs on buying a house, paid the transportation costs to move. And in the middle of the move, Sam's boss left for another company. And Sam became the only employee of the company in Europe to come to America. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why I have a daughter and son-in-law and grandchildren in Chicago instead of England. But I thought of that when I'm reading this. You're going about where you're and behaving wisely, making a good decisions. In verse 5, we continue on. And Saul set him over the men of war, and when he was accepted in the sight of all the people, in the sight of Saul's servants. In other words, he was behaving, he was doing well. Other people respected him in his service. Now we read in verse 6, 1 Samuel 18:6. Now it happened as they were coming home, David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistines. They were having battle with them. And the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, with musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000. Now, I'm sure that was rhetorical. Well, maybe not. Could have been true. But in other words, they were happy that their husbands and sons were coming home, that they had prevailed in the battle, and they were honoring whoever the leader was that had brought them to that. But it didn't look good in front of the king, because he was supposed to have the preeminent reputation. And so, verse 8, Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him. And he said, have they ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they only ascribe thousands? What more can he have but the kingdom? In other words, he's getting the praise of everyone. He's taking my place. So Saul eyed David from that day forward. We read the next verse in verse 1 Samuel 18:10. It happened the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. Now, this is right after this, so you can imagine Saul is very angry about this somebody having more preeminence in the eyes of the people than the king. And verse 11, and Saul cast the spear, for he said, meaning to himself, I will pin David to the wall. throwing the spear, waiting till he was lined up, throwing the spear at him, hoping to the spear would go through him and pin him to the wall. It takes a lot of strength to do that. Interestingly, David escaped his presence twice. Now, I'd be a little nervous if somebody's throwing a spear at me. I don't know that I would want twice to happen. But it happened twice. You see, King Saul continually tried to trick David to cause the death of David by the hands of the Philistines. We read about that. We also read in 1 Samuel 19:10, again, Saul sought to pin David to the wall with a spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence and drove the spear into the wall. David fled and escaped that night. Now, Saul wasn't happy. He would continue to try to kill David. He sent messengers to Saul, David's house, to watch him, spy him out, and kill him in the morning when he gets up. And Michal, David's wife, said, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." She knew what was going on. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And then Saul's army sought to kill David. Now they were after him. 1 Samuel 24:2, Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel, and they went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So they're out in the wilderness chasing David. He's fleeing for his life. And Saul came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave. Now, if those of you that have seen the topography of Israel, a lot of rocky areas there, and there are caves. And Saul went in to attend to his needs. Basically, he had to use the restroom. Wasn't going to use it out in front of all the other soldiers. So he went into a cave. And inside a cave, it's dark. What he did not know is that way deep in that cave, David and his men were. It says David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. And then 1 Samuel 24:4, and the men of David said to him, "This is the day which the Lord has said to you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as seems good to you." David could have killed him there. It was dark. When you're on the inside looking out, you can see the light of the one that silhouettes coming in. The one on the outside can't see coming in because you have bright light. You're coming into a dark cave. So David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. That means he was within an arm's length of him, taking a dagger and cutting off a chunk of clothing of the king's robe, which had to be distinctive or he wouldn't be the king. So now we read in verse 5, "It happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe." It was a dishonorable thing, but he wanted to demonstrate that he could have killed the king, but he didn't. He chose not to. And he said to his men, "The Lord forbid I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way, presumably unbeknownst at the time. Didn't realize he was next to death. Verse 8, David arose afterwards, went out of the cave, meaning probably from a high up place, and called out to Saul, saying, "My lord, my king." And Saul looked behind him. David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. And David said, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Indeed, David seeks your harm'? Look, this day your eyes have seen the Lord delivered you into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you, but my eye spared you. And I said, 'I will not stretch out my hand against the Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' Forever, my father, in other words, the king is referred to as father here. Yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand." Here's proof. "I cut off the corner of your robe and didn't kill you. Neither is there evil nor rebellion in my heart, and I haven't sinned against you. Yet you hunt my life and seek to take it." So we have this example of David, who is playing second fiddle to King Saul, and yet he would not kill King Saul, even though he was anointed to be king, because what did God look at when he was selecting king? Not who's the biggest and the strongest, not even who's the most clever. Who is the heart? Who is the heart of God? And so he was looking upon the heart. So David, the youngest son of Jesse, played second fiddle to all of his brothers. David was anointed to be the future king of Israel, but respected and did not raise his hand to hurt King Saul, despite Saul's desire to kill David. He respected God's judgment, and so played second fiddle for much of his life, for up until that point of his life, until Saul's death. What is the lesson of example three about David? We must keep our focus on God's plan for us. David had to keep his focus. Do we keep our focus? Is a question. Do we restrain ourselves from doing always what we want and looking for the longer framed outcome? The fourth and last example I have are James and John, the sons of Zebedee. It's really a short reference here. If we look in Matthew 4, verse 21, Christ selected several disciples. Matthew 4, verse 21, going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. In the boat was Zebedee, their father, mending their nets, and he called them. So he's bringing these pair of brothers to become his disciple. And they're listed then in Matthew 19 and verse 2 in the names of the 12 apostles. And they go through all of those 12 apostles, including James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. And so I presume that James is the elder and John is the younger, because it always says James, the son of Zebedee, and then his brother too. We go then to Matthew 20 and verse 29, and we have this story that we've heard. Now, we know that moms love their kids. That's pretty standard. They birth the little rascals out. Reminds me of a tow truck driver was repossessing a car. And the guy was saying, but wait a minute, it's my only transportation. And the tow truck driver was hired by the bank to repossess the car and had it all hooked up and going. And the tow truck driver says, I work for the bank. We carried you longer than your mother. So we can understand that Zebedee's wife, the mother of the sons, would want a special place for her sons. So in Matthew 20, verse 20, the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him, meaning Christ. And he said to her, what do you wish? And she said, grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one at your right hand and the other on your left in the kingdom. But Jesus answered and said, you don't know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that that I'm baptized with? And they said to him, we are able. This is because they didn't understand what was going to actually become, fully understand what was going to become of Christ. So he, meaning Jesus, said to them, you will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father. In other words, that's a decision yet to be made. And it's not their decision. And when the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. You know, did they put their mother up to this, to come over there? After all, we recall that, there are other stories, similar stories. But here, the mother is trying to prevail upon him, you know, melt the heart a little bit. Can't my two sweet little boys that are wonderful in every way do this? And I'm sure they were good, and good men, or Christ wouldn't have called them to be his disciples and later apostles. Interestingly enough, verse 25, but Jesus called them to himself and said, you know, the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. By the way, that's probably one of two things that Christ ever said about government. The rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give up his life a ransom for many. So Christ used this example of people, of the mother saying, can't you put my sons in positions of authority? And he said, it's not like the Gentiles. That's not how it works. You're not in position to exercise, like the Gentiles, great authority over someone. They're here to learn how to be servants. And that's critical for your understanding. If you want to be great, learn to be a servant. So their mother, at least, and presumably them, because they came with their mother, desired to be at the right and left hand, or be in a preeminent position. Not the best position to learn how to play second fiddle if you want to be in the first seat there. So this example here of the sons of Zebedee, Christ used this for this lesson to teach a lesson about position, responsibility, and service. It's not our position, but rather our heart of service to the work of God and the people whom God has chosen. It's our heart of service to the work of God and to God's people. We talked about Aaron. He was the second fiddle to his older sister Miriam. Aaron was the second fiddle to his younger brother Moses. Aaron did well when he was a spokesman for Moses, but Aaron was weak when Moses was not present. Yet Aaron was honored as the Levitical line of the priesthood flowed through him and the tribe of Levi. The lesson from his example, how strong and faithful are we when we're left to make a decision in the absence of someone who is over us? We have the summary of the example of Joshua. He followed the instructions of Moses, even in the face of death. He gave a good report when others were afraid to seize the promises of God. He followed God's instructions to take and distribute the promised land, dividing it among the tribes. The lesson we learn from example two of Joshua is, do we keep the instructions that God foremost in our mind when we follow the instructions of our human ruler? The example of David, example number three. David was the youngest son of Jesse, and he played second fiddle to all of his brothers. David was anointed to be the future king of Israel, but he had to play second fiddle and respect and did not raise his hand against the current king, King Saul, despite the king's desire to kill him. Even though David was promised the throne, should he kill Saul, the throne would be his. He knew that with the heart of God, that was not his place to do it. He respected God's judgment and didn't raise his hand against God's anointed. So the example for number three on David, keep our focus on God's plan for us. And a summary of the example of number four of James and John, the sons of Zebedee. Even though their mother wanted them to have foremost positions, Christ used this then to teach a lesson about position, responsibility, and service. God isn't looking to our position, but rather looks to our heart of service to do the work of God, to serve the people whom God has chosen. These examples are useful to us as we seek to follow God. In our lives, we're each handed a set of talents or abilities. You might say each one of us is given a violin or a fiddle. And the fiddle is a marvelous instrument. It's capable of producing something of great beauty and wonder. And each of us is given responsibilities before God. Each of us is called by God to fulfill God's expectations of us. And each day, we diligently practice with whatever God has given to us. And we do the best we can with what they're given. Or do we diligently practice, or do we fiddle around? Jesus Christ is the first chair, the first seat. He's the ultimate fiddle player. Let us push ourselves every day to do the best we can at playing second fiddle.